All right, so this is James lesson 3 called The Stories We Inhabit. Trying to get our minds wrapped around what shame is, where it comes from, and how it affects us even today. And I hope that by the end of this lesson, you have a little bit of inkling of the fact that shame does affect you today. I don't care how good of a home you grew up in. You still were passed down shame. And it still affects what you do today and how you see the world. And it's important that we know this so that we begin to understand what God is trying to do with us and in our lives, and what James is trying to get to, this integrated type of a life. We kind of relegate James to just a, well, this is what we do to have good faith. And that's really not what he's trying to get to. He's really trying to get to what does it look like to have a whole life. And if Luther would have understood that, he wouldn't have relegated James to the back of his list. I don't know if many of you know that. You know, Luther at first said that he didn't think James belonged in the Bible, in the canon. And so that when he actually compiled the New Testament, he actually put James at the end. Which is kind of interesting, isn't it? And yet, when you go back to look at how he looks at James, he actually does a fairly good job of it. But still, it's been one of those things that we think it's so easy to... It sounds so different than Paul. Remembering that James is probably, most likely, the first letter written before Paul's letters, so that it's Paul that is giving it a different twist, for a different reason. The interesting thing is, so there are scholars who talk about James being first, but there are also scholars that say we think maybe Galatians was first. If you read James and Galatians, you will see that they are like mirrors to one another. So that's a really interesting thing to see. Oh, they actually are talking about the same thing. So sit back. You don't need to take notes. This is just part of the story of... Chris, would you do me a favor? I don't even know which switch it is, but one of the lights that does this... So right there, and I don't know which it is, yeah. That's what I have to do still. Yes. There we go. Thank you. All right. So he's retelling the story from the King's Speech. The story centers around the relationship of George VI, the Duke of York, true story, this is about George VI, and Lionel Logue, an Australian colonial who has set himself up as a speech therapist. You know who George VI is, right? Mm-hmm. He's the mother of the current Queen Elizabeth. Yeah. So,
the father.
Don't change his identity here. So he is the father of Queen Elizabeth. George VI is beset by a debilitating stammer, which is probably a challenge given that his royal vocation requires public speaking of the highest order. And the specter of inheriting the crown looms over him because of the illness of his father and the embarrassing and compromising shenanigans of his older brother, Edward. Mm-hmm. Remember, Edward is supposed to be king. So George's faithful cheerleader, his wife, Elizabeth, has been searching for therapists and speech pathologists who can help her husband, but to no avail. All of them treat the problem reductionistically. That's a hard word to say. Some are mechanists who think the problem is merely biological, something to be cured by tongue exercises or other bodily gymnastics, or ridiculously by smoking to relax the throat. So these are things they tried. Others, most notably George's father, King George V, are decided intellectualists in their approach to the problem. For these intellectualists, young George, known as Bertie to his family, simply needs to muster the will to speak properly, as if he lacked the courage or fortitude, as if his stuttering was a kind of verbal laziness, as if it came down to a matter of simply choosing to speak properly. Most of us are intellectualists for everything. We think it's just a choice, and that's why we need to understand this shame thing. Thus, King George V regularly berates his son. "Enunciate," he shouts. This comes to a head after one of the king's Christmas broadcasts over the new wireless technology. King George, his father. Upon finishing his speech, a model of eloquence, he turns to Bertie and mocks him with what might mistakenly appear to be encouragement. Easy when you know how. Note the emphasis. I'm having a hard time reading this because it's in a small font and not Times Roman, so it's very difficult. So the king sets up Bertie for some practice. "Have a go yourself," he exhorts, admonishing him to face the microphone. "Sit up, straight back, face boldly up to the bloody thing, and stare it square in the eye, as you would any Englishman. Show who's in command." Bertie's efforts are pointless and hopeless, but his father tries to impress upon him the urgency of his being able to command his tongue. The king will soon be dead, and Edward's indiscretions will lead to his implosion, his brother. All of this while Hitler and Stalin are marching across the country, the continent. Who will stand between us, the jackboots, and the proletarian abyss? I need a magnifying glass.
My glasses?
His father asks. You! Bertie has to face the fact that he will be doing a lot more of this. And so once again, King George barks at his stammering son. Get it out, boy, and take your time. Form your words carefully. Relax! Try to do it! Do it! As one might imagine, neither mechanism nor intellectualism affects Bertie's stammer. And it is the failure of every other strategy that brings Elizabeth to the rather seedy environs of Mr. Logue's office. Logue's antipodean, I don't even know what that word means. His antipodean methods are considered unorthodox. But at the end of her rope, Her Royal Highness has ventured outside the fold to working class London in search of a cure, whom Bertie will call commoners, whom he's never had any contact with. The first encounter between Elizabeth and Lionel is fraught with a physicality that we can feel without realizing it. Each of them exhibits a very different bodily comportment to the world, each of which carries its own worldview. Elizabeth is circumspect, tight, clipped, and distant. Touching anything seems to be an invasion of her authority. Lionel is gangly and fluid, gregarious and familiar. He's comfortable in his own skin until he realizes that the Mrs. Johnson with whom he is speaking is in fact Her Royal Highness, the Duchess of York. Nonetheless, the rules for treatment cannot be compromised. If the Duke of York is to be treated by Mr. Logue, it will have to be in his office. In an air of familiarity and equality. My castle, my rules, Lionel stipulates. Elizabeth agrees. Lionel, while trying to show appropriate deference to the Royal Highness, nonetheless quickly establishes a space of equality by insisting on calling George by his familiar name, Bertie, to Bertie's chagrin. But Bertie becomes even more uncomfortable as this first appointment takes what seems to be a strange turn when Lionel deigns to ask him personal questions. Remember the distance here between king and commoner. Foreigner on top of it. What was your earliest memory? Lionel asks. I'm not here to discuss personal matters, Bertie replies tersely, then insists with a temper. But Lionel won't be dissuaded from this line of questioning. When did this defect begin? Though Bertie suggests he's always spoken with a stutter, Lionel assures him that no infant starts to speak with a stammer. So when did yours start? Bertie can't remember not doing it. Suffice it to say that the first appointment does not go well. Indeed, Lionel's unorthodox procedures irritate the Duke of York and seem like quackery compared to the mechanists he's seen in the past. What Bertie doesn't realize, of course, is that Lionel's trying to dig down into his story. Lionel, we might say, is something of a phenomenologist, a pre-incarnation of a French guy, who he talks about in this book, who discerns that Bertie's stammer is both bold, bodily, and psychological. It is part of the being in the world, arising at the intersection of body and mind, rooted in the in-betweenness of his incarnate existence. And if there's going to be a change for Bertie, it's going to be a kinesthetic conversion at the intersection of his body and his story. That's interesting. That's very important for us to know.
Read that again.
Mm-hmm. If there's going to be a change, it's going to be a kinesthetic conversion, which means that it has to be at the intersection of his body and his story. Remember how Ephesians, we talked about how important our body is. And yet when we come to Christianity, we think it's a mind thing, just a thinking thing. When Bertie eventually returns to Lionel seeking help, we can see Lionel's regimen working at this same intersection. So on the one hand, Lionel addresses the body, Here we see a humorous montage of physical exercises and material regimens to which Bertie is subjected. We see His Royal Highness shaking his jowls, hopping up and down, swaying his arms in looping arcs while humming Jack and Jill, even lying on the floor doing diaphragm exercises with the Duchess of York on his belly, which she quite enjoys. The scene of these visceral disciplines are spliced with scenes of his public speaking, which are showing some signs of improvement, but he's in no danger of being described as eloquent. Which is why, on the other hand, Lionel is fundamentally interested in getting to the bottom of Bertie's story, drilling down to the narrative that he now carries in his body.
Interesting.
The tale that has tied his tongue. There seems to be a new openness and vulnerability when Bertie visits Lionel after the death of his father. King George V's passing has stirred relational depths in his son. Pride loosed something that had congealed in his unconscious. In the distraction of handling Lionel's son's model planes, Bertie begins to open up. I always wanted to build models. The wistful way he says this gives us the impression that it never happened, either because it wasn't allowed or because his father was never available to help. In the course of the conversation, he admits that his father encouraged David, his older brother, to tease Bertie about his stuttering, as if he could be shamed out of his stammer. As Bertie continues to recount aspects of his family history, his stammer returns and halts the conversations. Lionel encourages him to sing his way through the stammer. But Lionel notices something else as Bertie is applying glue to a wing on the model plane. Are you naturally right-handed? He says. Left, Bertie replies. I was punished. Now I use the right. Any other corrections? Lionel inquires. And I think you should hone in on that. Because you hear that and you go, oh, that poor person. But corrections are the places where our shame comes in. Knock knees, Bertie admits. He was forced to wear metal splints to correct the problem. A solution that was agonizing for him. But straight legs now, he notes. As Lionel tentatively explores Bertie's story and family dynamics, he wonders who Bertie felt closest to. His closest relationships, it turns out, are with nannies. Not my first nanny, though, Bertie remembers painfully. She loved David, hated me. When I was presented to my parents for the daily viewing, and the stammering produced by the memory halts him. He can't even get it out. Lionel encourages him to sing through the story, and so the tune of Swanee River, Bertie recounts the painful pattern. She pinched me so I'd cry and be sent away at once. Then she wouldn't feed me. Far, far away. He then resumes the story in his regular voice. Took 3 years for my parents to notice. As you can imagine, it caused some stomach problems, even still. This brief testimony, the recounting of this personal story, will be a turning point for Bertie, for Lionel realizes that the only adequate prescription for Bertie's stammer is re-narration, retelling his story. That's where we're going today, because whether you think that story is tragic and that nothing like yours, it is. It's very much like yours. It's very much like mine. So we need to understand that stories form us. We identify shame as that feeling of fear, right, of not being enough. We're embarrassed. It's interesting that and I watched us do this. We keep saying that this definition of shame is different. How we see shame is that we're embarrassed. Well, that's what embarrassed means. Embarrassed means to feel shame. It means to feel like you're not enough. Somehow you are bad, not good enough. But to our minds, we've talked about this, shame is merely a neutral warning of possible impending abandonment. It warns us that we're extrapolating that sense of not being enough into the future. So we're projecting what the end goal would be if that I'm really not valuable. If I'm not valuable, what's the end goal of that? The end goal is to be isolated, right? To be completely alone and disconnected. So we devise ways of coming up with ways of avoiding that pain so that we define life as something other than relationship. And we do that in order to avoid the pain of that possible isolation. Because we're not enough, we want to be enough. And if it's not through a relationship, it can be through something else. I'll be valuable by being good. I'll be valuable by being smart. I'll be valuable by being successful. All of those contextual languages come as ways to avoid getting hurt in a relationship. Somebody saying we're not enough.
But can't you turn that into making an affection for something else, like a pet or a relationship with God, or with an invisible playmate?
The problem with that is that's not what life as God is defined. God defines life as relationship with Him and others. So the idea of I'm just going to be related with God, God says that's not life, right? Because He lives in perichoretic union, not in transactional one-on-one. So all of those things, that's where I'm getting to is we have so inculcated the idea of different ways of living other than what God says is life, that we have a really difficult time understanding that all of those ways aren't life. So some of those seem benign, but I hope that as we're digging through this, we're going to understand that even those ways that we've decided are life, are not benign. They actually will extrapolate down to a telos of death. So this is why I really want us to begin to understand it more. The problem is we didn't come up with those ideas on our own. We didn't come up with our contextual language on our own. And that's maybe one of those sticking points. Like, it wasn't a choice you made to have this contextual language. It actually came down to you, was passed down to you. Your shame response, your contextual language was actually passed down to you, which is what it means when Scripture talks about sin being passed down from generation to generation. That's what he's talking about. So it's not a matter of I'm going to choose to make life about this so much as this is what I've learned life is really about. And they're
passed. Stop the crazy train.
yeah, we can actually. Which is what James is about, right? He wants us to say there is another way out of that. All of us have been passed down a shame response. A different way of doing life other than relationship. All of us. The best of us, even. We still have that. I would say that a lot of us have a very difficult time, though, digging down here. Mainly because it's painful. And also because especially in Western world, since the Enlightenment on, we don't think about emotions being very important. So we don't really pay attention to them. But we received those shame responses from our earliest caregivers. So it could have been your mom and dad or whoever. For Bertie, it was the nannies and his father, and then his siblings as well. The problem with all of those contextual languages is they all have a telos, right? They all have an end goal, they impart. So you've been passed down a shame response, a contextual language, but every one of those contextual languages has a telos, has a goal to it, where it tells where life is going. And so all of those have a telos that isn't what God says life is supposed to aim toward. Because all of those teloses are dualistic. They say that at the end of life, there will only be either good and bad, or successful and failure, or smart and dumb. All of the contextual languages have a telos that says it's one or the other. And the problem with a dualistic language is that if you're not the one, you're the other. And the other is always not valuable, right? So the danger of those learned responses is that they form us into specific types of people. People who see the world as an us and them world. A disintegrated world where your goal is to make it to the us category. and to make sure you're separated from the them category. So if your contextual language is good or bad, which is most religious contextual languages, right? If that's your contextual language, I just want to be good, then what you're doing is you're setting yourself up. You've learned a story that says there's either good or there's bad, and I want to make sure I'm in the good category and not in the bad category. And therefore, the world is made up of us and them, good people and bad people. And I'll begin to see the world that way, and I will respond to the world that way. And tell me that we do not see this like
right now.
Crazy, yeah. Crazy. Yeah, that's what we're seeing. And that's where we've got to understand what's going on. So that our shame responses are not only passed down, but they're passed down in stories. Though the responses are practiced ways of avoiding the pain of shame, we don't teach those responses didactically, right? We don't sit our kids down and say, hey, now listen, we want to avoid shame at every cost. So we've come up with some great ways to live life so that we never feel shame. We don't do that, right? Have you ever done that?
No.
Although Bertie's dad may have come kind of close, right, to basically saying, hey, you're going to be king, and we've got ways to be king so that you look good, so that you're not feeling that shame. The problem is we don't realize that we're either passing it down, nor do we realize that we're receiving that, because we don't remember being taught that. But the reason we don't is because we don't impart shame responses didactically. We impart them through story, through embodied story, through the way we live. Remember, our first encounters with attachment is touch, right? Or lack of touch. And then it's voice, tones of voice, and then language to actually make sense of all of that. Those are employed consistently throughout your own beginning days. But they carry the sense of a story. So when we talk about emotion, we're talking also about the sense that you get of a story. Because stories help us understand how the world works. So Karen had a hard time explaining what the Golden Compass was all about. And all of us actually, and this is why I wanted you to just give a little thing about what your story is about. You just giving a 5-word thing doesn't help anyone. Like, if you really love this story, I love this story of Mancalove. I've read the book. I've seen the movie twice. I have burst into tears just as many times at each one of the viewings or hearings. I want you to feel that. But you can't feel it unless you hear the story. Just for me to say, it's about the importance of everyone needing connection. Mm-hmm. For those of you who haven't read or seen it, you're like,
what?
But those of you who have, what do you feel? You're just like, no, you got. Because this story, and there's no way you can explain the story. If I tell you the facts of the story, you actually might not read it. But the story gives us a sense of something underneath. It's we're actually created as story people, storytellers and story hearers. So because stories teach us a way of being in the world in a much deeper and expansive way than mere information can do for us. It's why we tell stories. So because of the repeated practices in our life, for Bertie, it began with the nanny, right? She repeatedly would pinch him, and she would repeatedly not feed him. Every time Bertie's stuttering would happen, Bertie's father then reinforced that story that the nanny was actually telling him by the way she was touching or not touching, speaking or not speaking to him. So that she was telling a story about how the world works. His father and his brother were reinforcing that story of how the world works. And basically, the story he was getting was, people who have some kind of deformity, people who have problems, are not as valuable as others. He was being told by embodiment a story about an us and them world. And we actually see it in the fact, if you actually read this or see this movie, you'll see that when he first meets Lionel, he's a commoner, and he says to him, "You're a commoner. I have never talked to a commoner before." And it's interesting because the man is portrayed, Bertie is portrayed as a rather compassionate man, but he sees Lionel as a them. And he's different, he's strange. But he says something like, "I didn't know commoners were like me." The reason he didn't know that is not because he didn't have the information. It was because the story he had growing up was embodied and integrated into his life so that it became what was true. It's just true that people who have problems are not as valuable as other people. Yeah.
I was gonna
put that up.
Okay, sorry.
No, I'm not gonna do it because I don't have time.
Oh, I don't want to.
Go ahead.
Well,
go.
It's okay. If you chose not to do it.
Do you remember the name?
No, I don't remember the name. Oh. It was. I have it. I saved it, but.
I wrote it down somewhere.
Yeah.
So and if you want stories and things like that, lots of places to go. It's pretty interesting.
This morning on Fox News, Dr. Fonz, I forget his name, has a learning disability and has written, I think, a number of books explaining how we get around. It was,
yes.
I think, dyslexia he had. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So now you can see from Bertie's story, right, what's happening with shame and how it gets embodied into that's how we see the world. Without it ever being didactically taught. In fact, what happens is our worldview becomes second nature to us so that it's just truth to us. Well, that's just how it is. The practice responses of his father taken in were repeated to him, and it became embodied so that his body actually followed that as a truth, despite any knowledge to the contrary. So in other words, just because you have knowledge that this and this are equal doesn't mean you actually live that way. Because it's the stories that have been embodied that actually form you. This is what we talked about. Remember James K. Smith talks about the habits that form you? It's what you actually do with your body and have had done to your body that actually form you. We're formed by the stories that are habitually embodied. So, just an example. When I was growing up, when we would drive through certain neighborhoods, right away, I can remember hearing, "Lock your doors, roll up the windows."
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That is an embodied habit that gave me a worldview. What story did I hear about the world then?
It's not safe.
There are places that you go that people are after you, that people are dangerous. There's an us and them world out there, and we've got to protect ourselves from the them. Did my parents ever say that?
No.
Well, some of my parents did some.
They probably denied it.
Yes.
They didn't explain it.
It was just an embodied, like literally, I'm reading this and going, "Oh yeah, lock the doors, roll up the windows," mm-hmm. when you're in certain places.
Mm-hmm.
That still comes up for me today.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Despite my knowledge, it's still like, "Lock the door. Don't let anybody see I'm locking the door." Mm-hmm. Like, there's still a piece of me there.
Well, so much so that cars automatically lock when you come in
the
car.
Oh, I thought about that and I thought, isn't that interesting?
Mm-hmm.
Where did that come from? Mm-hmm. Interesting, huh?
So
our dualistic mindsets that we've learned, those contextual languages that we've learned through stories that were reactive, right, to the possibility of shame, they're always disconnecting from somebody else. Always. All contextual languages are meant to disconnect from some other. This is why understanding and recognizing our own shame responses is so important, because those are the places that we're disconnecting. And when we go all the way back to Genesis 1, we understand that disconnection is sin. Not behavior, but disconnection. And it's that pulling away. We need to understand that there are two stories vying for our attention all the time. One is God's story that says we're inextricably connected to God and he loves it, and we're made to continue connecting God and others. It's a good world, but it's broken, and it's being restored by incarnate reconciling. That's God's story. It's a good world, but it's broken and being reconciled by incarnate reconciling, connecting. It's not the story we've been told, though. The other story is we're on our own, and it's up to us to make ourselves indispensable and valuable. It's a world broken to pieces, and it's continuing to disintegrate. Our only response is, let's get out of here. Right? That's the story we've been told. And those two stories are vying for each other. I want to play real quick a piece. One of my favorite men.
So for 25 years, it's been the privilege of my life to work with gang members, and they've taught me everything.
You know, this is Father Greg. Really, I just finished.
But especially in the last couple of years, they taught me how to text, and I'm so grateful to them. I find that it sure beats the heck out of actually talking with people. And so I'm pretty dexterous at it, LOL and OMG and BTW, you know, and the homies have taught me a new one, OHN. Which apparently stands for, oh, hell no. I've been using that one quite a bit lately. And so there I am with two homies, Manuel and Juancho. They're older vatos who work in my at Homeboy Industries. We have 400 employees there. And guys have been to prison and tattoos. They do a variety of things. They're going to help me give a talk in Palm Desert at a high school. And so we meet at 9. We get in the car. 15 minutes on the road, Manuel's in the front seat, and he gets an incoming text, and he chuckles to himself. I said, what is it? He goes, oh, it's dumb. It's from Snoopy back at the office. Well, I had just seen Snoopy. Snoopy gave me a big abrazote as the day began. And Snoopy and Manuel work together in the clock-in room where they clock in all our workers. It's a tough job. I said, well, what's he say? Oh, gosh, hang on. It's dumb. Hey, dog, it's me, Snoops. Yeah, they got my ass locked up at county jail. They're charging me with being the ugliest vato in America. You have to come down right now, show them they got the wrong guy. Well, we died laughing, you know, and then I realized that Manuel and Snoopy are enemies, rivals. They used to shoot bullets at each other. Now they shoot text messages. And there's a word for that, and the word is kinship. How can we achieve a certain kind of compassion that stands in awe at what the poor have to carry, rather than stand in judgment at how they carry it? For the measure of our compassion lies not in our service of those on the margins, but in our willingness to see ourselves in kinship with them, in mutuality. It was a great privilege of my life to know Cesar Chavez as a friend, and I can remember once a reporter had commented to him, wow, these farm workers, they sure love you. And Cesar just shrugged and smiled, and he says, the feeling's mutual. And that's what we want to achieve, is this sense of mutuality, where we obliterate once and for all the illusion that we're separate. No us and them, just us. There's an idea that's taken root in the world. It's at the root of all that's wrong with it. And the idea would be this, that there just might be lives out there that matter less than other lives. How do we stand against that idea? Well, Homeboy Industries was born nearly 25 years ago.
So,
who is that, Jill?
That's Greg Father Greg Boyle. We've done a Bible study where we've actually used his book called tattoos of the heart. What I want to make us aware of that we inhabit stories that make us kinds of people. And all of our contextual language stories make us the kinds of people who see the world as an us and them world. Mm-hmm. James is going to address the rich and the poor throughout his book. Mm-hmm. It's an us and them viewpoint. And we have a difficult time seeing that we actually see that. That's how we see the world. Are we aware of the stories that we inhabit? Are we aware because we know what we believe and the doctrines we have in our head? We say everyone's equal, but is it how we live? Do we see as everybody as valuable as everybody else? Or do we see it in how we respond to when our stories get bumped into, which is happening today? Our stories, us and them, are getting bumped into this last week, right? Terribly. And I can't believe how many of us get our stories bumped into, and we say, we believe what God says, we are Christians and we love everyone, we see them as valuable, but if there are people who are going to make me feel unsafe, if there are people who are going to make me feel like my language, my contextual language isn't going to get fulfilled, well, then I'm going to look at a different way of looking at life. So I'm asking Lissa to give to you just a little tiny piece of her presentation that she brings to churches who want to volunteer with Emmanuel House, so that they don't come into Emmanuel House with these us and them viewpoints. We cannot work with one another in mutually dependent ways if we come with that kind of viewpoint. So Lissa, why don't you come and share with us?
I was just going to give the disclaimer that I don't like talking in front of people. It's like my mom does. So having like 40 faces staring at me.
Pretend she's not here.
Yeah. So this is just a piece of a training that we do that's 2.5 hours. So I mean, I have 10 minutes.
Because that comes with me, right?
So I just want to unpack the word poverty a little bit, because it's a big word and a loaded word, and we all come with our own definitions and experiences that sort of shape this word. So I'm just going to take a very small bite out of this very big concept. So the first step to grappling with poverty is to be aware of the lens through which we see it. So we all have lenses through which we see poverty and economic class. And all of our lenses are unique to ourselves. So I think it's important. Our lenses can be incredibly detrimental, especially when just trying to grapple with this, but also when trying to engage this kind of work, unless we're aware of them. And if we're just aware of our lenses, you can't change them, you can't take them off. We'll always have them on. But being aware of them can help them serve you rather than be a hindrance. So with that in mind, I'm curious what just stream of conscious thinking, what comes to mind when you hear the word poverty?
Cycle up. Lack of resources. A lot of people.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm voiceless.
Yeah.
Unseen. Frightening.
Or frightened.
Oh. Stuck.
Stuck, yeah. Are there any like visceral sort of feelings associated? And we all have filters, so a lot of these answers are coming from probably just being educated about poverty. But are there any, I mean, I know it's kind of vulnerable to...
Bad smelling.
Great, thank you.
I clean dirty,
good. Yeah. Like dilapidated houses.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm.
No socks.
Mm-hmm.
Animals.
Yeah, good. I think it's helpful. Again, I think it's uncomfortable, but it's like those are always in the back of our minds, whether we say it or not. So it's, I think the more we can bring it to the forefront of ourselves, the more helpful it can be. Because I think, again, we all have experiences that have sort of shaped this word for us, and whether it's like the short-term mission trips to Mexico and you helped build houses, you sort of have, and I think for most people, not for all, we have kind of a single story that we tell about poverty. And again, to no fault, just that's how we sort of shape our experiences and bias, and the way that our brain stores information. So I think it's, and I'm sure many people here too have had other experiences that have helped you understand that poverty is a very wide spectrum. So it's not one single story, it's not one single house, not one single family, not one single type of clothing, type of keeping a house, type of budgeting. It's a very wide spectrum. And what I say is it's a spectrum of experiences and systemic issues that affect people. So rather than people are poor, like it's a spectrum of experiences, but also systemic, like the structure of our society, and that's going to affect people, and it'll affect people across economic class divides. So not just in sort of one economic class, because it can be a situational poverty experience, it could be generational, it can be extreme poverty, it can be working class poverty. Robin said lack of resource, and rather than using one word to define this sort of myriad of experiences with the word poverty, I think it's helpful to use the word resources and think about poverty in terms of resources. So resources being what we each need to thrive in a society. And Ruby Paines is someone who's done a lot of work, research in poverty. And she came up with 8 different resources.
Sure, passes out.
Yeah. So this sheet sort of lists the 8 different resources that there are: financial, emotional, mental, spiritual, physical, relational, language, and knowledge. So then when thinking about poverty, it would be a difficulty in accessing a type of resource. So it can be all 8, or it can just be 1, and it's not always financial. So I think that can be helpful. Again, to understand this, how it can be such a spectrum, and also understanding that someone who we may consider to be in poverty or affected by a cycle of poverty, they may lack finances, but they may be educated. They may, you know, struggle to access any number one of these resources. I won't read through all of these. I think it's helpful to sort of read through on your own if you're interested, but does someone want to just read one or two of these? Read through the examples.
On the back of the page where it says resources.
Yeah. Sorry, resources defined. This one.
Is there a specific one?
Anyone. You just pick one.
I'll read emotional.
Great.
Friends, so this is emotional. Friends, family, who you feel you can talk to, meet with when needed, ability to access/pay for counseling or therapeutic services, ability to focus on self-care or wellness, choice regarding work-family balance, positive coping strategies to manage stress, access to social and emotional learning included in your education, work schedule that allows for free time. Inhibiting factors are working multiple jobs or working the third shift.
Okay. And then I'll just pick one other one to read. So physical, living in a community with clean water, limited pollution, low crime, living in a home free of lead and other contaminants, feeling a sense of safety in your home or community, access to doctors, hospitals, clinics in your community, living in a community that's safe enough to be outside for exercise and play. So I think it's helpful to begin to build, again, kind of, rather than a single story, a myriad of experiences as you can start to see when just fleshing these out a little bit. And to understand when a lot of these resources are connected. So if you don't have access to one resource, it's likely that it'll be difficult to access a different type of resource. So going back to understanding the lens through which we see the world, I think it's helpful to ask, where did your resources come from? What resources do you have? Who provided them? What resources allowed you to access greater resources? So if you have a college degree, sort of what resource was behind that college degree that allowed you to access that? Not all resources are equally available to everybody, which I think you can see just from this list. So the back is just a quick activity, and it sort of fleshes out these resources in more concrete examples. So if you just want to go through and read and check the ones that apply to you.
Did we have enough for everybody?
Yes? Is there extras?
Yeah. One extra.
Everyone done? Mm-hmm. Any thoughts? Yeah.
One that jumped out at me as meaningful is my parents told me I could be anything I wanted to be. My dad used to always tell me that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's huge for women.
Yeah.
And that's really blessed my life. So that one sort of leaped off the page.
Yeah.
To me.
Yeah, I think that's a great one because I don't think that's even just in a middle class culture, it's not always a given.
I really didn't, I mean, some of these I didn't even realize is appreciate as resources.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Even an inheritance, I don't plan on getting money, but I'm going to get a sofa. Like, I mean.
Yeah.
Yeah, really. You know, so.
Yeah.
It's a resource.
Yeah. Yeah. And
you kind of. I think it'd be interesting if I gave this to my brothers. Mommy was the art. Because my brother has said, my mom, my dad didn't encourage me to go to college. I'm like, they encouraged me and my youngest brother to go. So where in the mix did you miss the whole?
Yeah.
Some of these, it would just be interesting in a family dynamic for him. Because he thought we lived in poverty.
Huh.
Which we didn't.
Yeah.
My mom said we had a house. You know what I mean? So his definition is completely different than.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, the also if you have children, I think it'd be interesting for them to fill this out, because a lot of times, again, resources help you access more resource, and so, and that's also in the same case with a lack of resource. A lack of resource is going to make it difficult to access any type of resource, and that's the cycle of poverty and the cycle of disadvantage.
It seems like it also helps you to be independent. Like a lot of these, like public transportation, like you have to be dependent on someone else to help you survive.
Yeah, yeah, it's a great point, because I think something I notice a lot in the families that we work with, are their relational resources are much higher than my own. Mm-hmm. They raise their children intergenerationally, and yeah, it's an interesting, I think it's an interesting point. The last thing I'll say is that on the spectrum, I think it's also helpful to know, I've worked really the last 10 years with lower income families, and I can't tell you one family I've worked with who would consider themselves poor. So I think it's really important to, before identifying someone else's poor, to understand the way that they would identify themselves. Mm-hmm. And this is often because you're always looking at your own life in comparison to those around you. So if your life is lived mostly with other people who work shift work jobs, you're not going to consider your wage to be much different. And that affects your agency in the world. So if you see yourself as not being maybe necessarily labeled with a word like poor that sort of contains so much in it, you have so much more agency in the world, and that's a resource. So I think it's very helpful, and it can be detrimental to try to identify somebody. I think if you're specifically talking about income, lower income is a good way if you need something to kind of.
Melissa, can I ask you, the families that you work with or do work with, are they Christians?
Not necessarily.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I think sometimes, you know, in the church, we do get this sense that these resources are blessings from God, and that those that don't have as much maybe don't have as much because they aren't connected with God. You know what I'm saying? So that one of the reasons we're rich in having the resources. You know, so I'm throwing it out there as a way that sometimes I think
people think.
Mm-hmm, we did, right? That, you know, those are thoughts out there in the way we can look at poverty.
Sure, yeah, I think mm-hmm. it's very true. I think it's a very prevalent way of thinking. I think it lacks a lot of understanding for, And I think I've had people in trainings say things like, you know, families without a particular faith don't have hope, and I just don't think that's true. That's not been my experience. Mm-hmm. But I think it's a lack of, you get to know a family and all of your sort of ideas are shed. I think that's kind of the only way.
It's through relationship.
Yeah.
And I think for the most part, maybe sometimes upper middle class Christians may say, like, or even go so far as to think that, like, you know, since I've given my life to Christ, he's blessed me with these possessions. Maybe say that, but maybe even feel like it's earned, you know, like I've worked hard for it, and, you know, I think it's easy to, right, yeah, I think it's easy to go
go down that path, even if you don't articulate
yeah.
it, you know?
Yeah, and or even just see all assets as beneficial,
right?
Mm. At, rather than maybe preventing me from
right.
having. I think you begin to see again. There's a freedom, also, and not. I mean, the cycle of poverty is a real thing, and it's a very difficult thing. But I don't. It doesn't take away. A lot of times, the I think there's something else it gives.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that our resources and lack of needing mm-hmm. other people, a lack of. Lack of need
mm-hmm.
Prevents us from
mm-hmm.
some other resources.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Lisa.
Yeah.
Thank
you.
I know she can
talk
to you.
So why I wanted her to just start poking our boxes a little bit on the fact is we do have us and them filters. Here's an interesting thing. She knew nothing of her lesson. What, did you hear
uh-huh.
the
mm-hmm.
same stuff?
I wonder if you had prompted her to say
no. Nope. She didn't really know what we're going. I just want us to understand that we have stories underneath us, and I do think it's interesting. And she picked up on it right away, and she was very kind about it
mm-hmm.
because she said, all of your answers were, they're not visceral.
Mm-hmm.
Basically what she's saying was you're giving us Christian answers that we know, that you think we're supposed to have. No, you think dirty, you think lazy, right?
Mm-hmm.
She came home from the last training she did, and she said, so they actually bring in her clients, and the clients talk to the churches, which I actually was going to do, and I thought, how am I going to get all of this in? But one of the clients said to the church there, she said, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking that you think poor people are lazy. She said, and I love it, because I think she was an African-American woman, and Lisa really, she said, she pointed at the people and she said, don't you dare think we don't work as hard as you do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the type of thing that we need to understand is all of those stories that we tell, those stories that we have behind as our background, they're most likely not true.
Mm-hmm.
We might have the information about everybody is equal. You know, Father Greg says there aren't people that are less valuable than others.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, we actually live that way. And that's where James is trying to get to. That's why, for him, rich and poor really just irks him. To see the world as that. And to understand what we're called to be. Priests who intervene and who actually allow intervention into our own lives as to this wall that we have built up. And it is all comes out of different kinds of shame. So,
well, I think it's interesting, like what you said, that we have one experience in our life that shape, you know, that then shapes the rest of our perspective on something. We don't let anything else
completely.
In shape that
yep.
perspective, and
yep.
it just erodes everything else around it. Then we can extrapolate that on to other groups and other
yep.
situations, and it just becomes our.
It becomes our way of life, and there, it's hard for us to even believe that that's not the truth. It's just not the truth until you actually have. A lot of embodied experiences. Of course, like Lisa said, she's worked in this field for 10 years,
mm-hmm.
and her work has brought us into that work and changed us as well.
Mm-hmm.
And the more we're involved in that, the more
mm-hmm.
our, first of all, the more our lenses get exposed, and then having to reform them. So, if we are to reform our stories, the stories that we've been passed down with, those embodied habits that we don't even realize that we have incorporated into our lives, if we're to reform those, we're actually going to have to reform those in the same way. We're going to need to have embodied habits, right? So it's not enough. In fact, it's actually not the first thing, is not information in our heads. So it's very difficult to say this to you when all I'm doing right now is giving you information.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why we do many things in this class. This is why we have these embodied experiences. Now, we haven't had for the last three things. I keep on having all these things I want us to do, and I just have to learn how to manage my time better. But I want us to practice. And it's why I'm so adamant about you understanding shame so that you practice. I asked you this week to be aware of your shame responses and the patterns that you have about shame. I want you to do that. If you don't engage in that, if I suggest you do something and you don't engage in that, you are, all you're doing is accumulating knowledge to make you further away rather than action, because nothing will change your worldview and how you actually live and be in this world without an embodied habit. It's got to be a habit and it's got to be embodied. It's got to be involve your body, hearing, all your senses, and it's got to be a habit. There, James Smith says that he believes that one of the reasons evangelicalism has failed, and I know all of you are going, it's not failed. Oh, yes, it has. And one of the reasons he believes it's failed is because we have thrown out embodied habits in the church. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. We think it's horrible to go through ritual, to do rites, and yet the world lives on rituals. We've talked about this in Ephesians, that we have habits and rituals that we do every single day that are telling a story that is not the story that is God's story nor the true story. And we involve ourselves with those every single day. But then we get in the church and we say, well, it's not important. In fact, it's horrible to do rituals. It's horrible to have a specific liturgy that we go through all the time. And yet, that is the way our bodies and our minds and our whole beings work. It's how we get shaped. So he believes that that is actually one of the biggest failures that has happened in the evangelical church, and why we need to, and why he calls us back to habits, embodied habits. And so this is actually what James is doing. So if you're reading it in the Greek, you might understand this better, but he uses the present tense for the things he asks us to do so that he says to us, we need to practice these things. They need to become habits. And the first thing is vulnerability. It actually needs to become a habit. We talked about vulnerability. It's something we are. It's not something we choose to do or choose to be. But there is a practice that we can be intentional about being vulnerable, about being open to being known and open to knowing others fully. We do that, we choose to intentionally be vulnerable and practice that in order to be able to function creatively, in order to be able to name and tend and make space for others. We cannot name and tend and make space for others unless we are vulnerable. We can't do it. It is impossible to name worth in someone else and it be a sincere, integral part of who you are giving out, because you need to be giving out fully of who you are in order to be able to give out naming and tending and bringing flourishing to the world, which is what we're called to do. So we need to make vulnerability a practice. Vulnerability is the one thing that will actually address shame. So you want to keep your shame and you want to keep your contextual languages going, then by all means, don't intentionally be vulnerable, because all you're doing there is making sure you're hiding that shame, ignoring and avoiding vulnerability, which means you're avoiding connection, the kind of connection that God is talking about, that James is talking about. So when I talk about connection, yeah, we can talk about the connection of, oh, I have 950 Facebook friends. That's not integrated connection. I think we all know that, right? And yet we're in a world where that just is enough. And connection also doesn't mean just because you know their name, but it's this integrated connection where I'm fully and vulnerably open to you. You know my story, I know yours, and we're actually sharing more of our story. It isn't a place where all we ask to each other is, you know, what? I'll never forget going into a brand new church in a brand new Bible study. I walk in, and what everyone is talking about is the number of the Sherwin-Williams paint they're using on their wall. And I'm not kidding you, that's what they were all talking about. And at that point, I actually had no idea that there were like specific numbers for paints. Like they all know the numbers of the paint that's on their wall. All that to say, we're gonna walk in here next week and our walls are gonna be painted and I know the number.
I think you're going gray.
We're going gray. Anyway, that's not integrated connection. You know that, right?
Do you think that's why artists and writers have such a hard time, because they're so vulnerable that people don't give it back?
Absolutely, because what do people, what's the first thing you say, or let's, instead of poor, when you say artist, what's the first thing you say? First thing you think?
Poor.
Poor. Crazy. Weird, right? Like, well, you know, they're the artsy type.
Right.
When you say artsy type, yeah. We'll use nice words, but really we mean just weird, right? And I know, but right? Yes?
Yeah.
That's what we think. And part of that is because they are more vulnerable. And so to us, that's weird, right? That's
we're
weird.
All weird. They're not getting it back.
They're not getting back, right. And so then there's this tension.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
There was a commercial on this, or it wasn't a commercial, it was on Fox News. And it was like, if you have an Android, talking about dating, if you had an Android versus an iPhone, and I was kind of like, huh? What are you talking about? It's your chances of how your date was going to perceive you. I thought, what in the world are we doing talking about? Tell us.
Yeah, but all of those things can go into that, no matter if it's today or it was, you know, when we were growing up as little kids.
But is that...
Yeah, and we'll kind of get more to the nitty-gritty through this. I kind of want to just get to a point where we know a little bit more personally. This is always my hardest part as a teacher. I want you to know this stuff, but I want you to know this stuff. Mm-hmm. And there are times when I just want to come to each one of you and shake you like, mm-hmm. God, get this. Please desire this. And I can't. I can only pique your interest and hope that the Holy Spirit, and pray that the Holy Spirit is actually working on you and that you're not putting up a wall, what the Holy Spirit's talking about. Because this is vulnerable, and I know that we don't like vulnerable, but we need to get to that point where we understand that. So the very first thing that we need to know about making a practice of vulnerability is that we need to admit that we lack. So James, right? James says, if you lack... And we need to have this admission of we lack. And what that means is we need to be able to say to ourselves and to others, I am not complete by myself. Now that is the antithesis of the American motto, right? I am not complete by myself. I don't know everything. I believe, but I actually don't believe in many pieces of my life. Because that's evidenced in how you practice, how you are in the world. And see, I mean, things come up to me, I just want to go, what are you doing about this issue? You say this, but you don't do this.
It's so hard to see stuff in ourselves. It's much easier to see it in someone else, which actually is probably a reflection of...
Almost always. Yeah. I am not fully integrated. I have compartments, right? I can say I believe everything God says, but then over here, I live my life this way. That isn't what God says. I have habitual responses to life that are still focused on me. That the focus is making sure that my contextual language gets accomplished, that I am smart or good or safe, all of those things. I still have habitual responses to those things. Remembering that a practice of something like vulnerability is supposed to be a reflection of who God is, right? If we are trying to reform our stories, we're going to try to reform our stories so that it actually looks like God's story. And if we're asked to be vulnerable, it means God's vulnerable. And it means that somehow, he actually admits that he lacks. Now, that sounds like heresy, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. But how What?
He created us, right? So he'd have a relationship.
So we'd have a relationship. But even before that, how does he mirror the fact that he says all the time, I lack?
Exactly.
Because he never refers to himself as me. Mm-hmm. Right? He looks at himself as us. Mm-hmm. And in fact, when at the end of chapter 3 of Genesis, there, God, the Trinity, is disturbed because Adam now is like one of us. That's the worst thing that can happen. That Adam now feels like one of us. That, what that shows is God understands that to be complete is to be us and not me. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. So, admission of lack, which opens up to the possibility of the other. Because I've admitted I lack, that I'm deficient, it allows the possibility that the other has what I don't have. That the other can supply and help me to move toward completeness. That's a big admission there. That someone else can actually help me move toward completeness. That means I refrain from scoffing or taking a posture that I don't need what others are offering. And Lissa touched on this just a little bit, as did Angela. The poor, and Lissa hates that when I use that, so I've been trying to think, how do I do that? Because I'm
stealing them.
Just other people who are suffering the pain of being disconnected, we'll talk about that in a little bit. If I take the posture of they have nothing to offer me, that is not being vulnerable. What's being vulnerable is they have something to offer me that I actually don't have. And that is a concept, I think, and that's what the concept that Lissa finds the hardest, and she will say, the hardest people to work with in this environment are church people. Because they come with the attitude that we have something to give these people that they don't have, period. Stop there. And if you enter that way, you have absolutely shamed them. They have something to offer us. And Angela said it, right? They have a way of living, a way of being in the world that we don't have. And that is dependency, right? That is something they have to offer us. Do you remember, I think our last project over at Manual House, the painting project, where Jean came and talked with all of us. And wasn't that he was so like, I love that you guys are doing this for us. This is so cool. And people were interacting with them. I said to that to Lissa, I said, you know, that was really helpful for us to be able to interact and see that, you know, he's just like us. And she laughed and she said, you do know that Jean came from a very high upper class, very educated place. Mm-hmm. But see, we see him differently, right? Because he's a refugee and because he's African. Not even African American. Where did he come from? I don't remember. We see him as something different, and our worldview begins to treat him that way.
When we see that with everybody, I was just listening to a podcast on this about ableness, which I was like, I didn't even know that this was a thing, and like how I love this podcast called the Liturgist Podcast.
Yes, that's a good one.
And they were talking about this exact same thing about a woman who was blind and how her biggest frustration with people is that people constantly feel like they have something that only they can offer her that she can offer them.
Right, wow. Right, exactly.
And I was like, oh my gosh.
But that's how we all are,
and that's,
right?
And that's how we treat anybody that's not exactly like us.
Exactly.
I think for me in my work environment, one of the things that I enjoy is when, you know, I've presented a practice that I use and say, you know, this is a suggestion that might blow up. And then later on when someone will come and just kind of encourage that has been helpful for them.
Yes.
And it's like, it's great, you know, and it's like, it's not about me. It's just about something that I've given you that I've just seen that is, it's benefit.
Yes.
It doesn't just benefit me.
It benefits others.
Whatever else you're going to be doing along the way. So
right.
Like, oh.
Yeah, so that's a huge thing for us. We have to understand that our intended state, the state that we were made to actually occupy, is one of vulnerability. It's one of nakedness. That's where we're intended to be. the purpose, our purpose of being vulnerable is actually to be able to join in participating with the other in a mutually dependent way. We just have this weird idea that being connected to somebody, like Karen says, is about me giving to you without the mutual benefit of you giving to me. It has to be that. To be able to see the other as equally valuable, which is how God sees the Father and the Father's, how Father sees the Son and the Son sees the Holy Spirit and the Holy Spirit sees the Father. That's the pericretic value of seeing one another.
Joe,
yeah.
Even like as Christians think that unsaved people don't have anything to offer us. And I realized with my neighbor, oh my goodness, I learned so much. And I even thanked her before she left. Like, you know what? You just said, hey, come on over. It doesn't matter how my house looks. And was very hospitable. And just the books that she read and would talk about it. And I was just like, wow.
I mean,
like growing up thinking like, we're the ones that have to give to the world.
Yes.
And they have to, you know, like, nothing for us because we got it all together and we know everything.
And I think that that is our biggest obstacle to get over as the church is because we have the gospel, as if we have it, we have something to give the world that they and they don't have anything to give to us. And Lissa sees this all the time, particularly Christians and Muslims. And it's a shame. I mean, we've experienced it, and there are stories I would tell you that I'll just start crying to tell you about how we as Christians view someone from another faith, let alone someone from another culture. It's appalling, and it's not the gospel when we see them as not as valuable, that they actually don't have something to give us. To think that is actually disconnection. So who is the other? Because of vulnerability, it opens up to who the other could be. So the other isn't just someone who might be a Christian or someone who might come to be a Christian. We have to be open to who the other might be because most likely the other who has something to give you that you don't have is not going to be like you. So that if all only people you're connected to are white, rich evangelicals, you are not a reflection of the Trinity.
You're missing a lot of your life.
Huge, but more importantly, you're not embodying and incarnating the gospel.
So how do you go do that? Like,
wow.
So I'm from Chicago, and then, no. then I come home to, like, do I move? No. Do I, you know what I'm saying? Like, I'm struggling with the whole, I'm going to go help you, but I'm going to go home to my safe place. And we do it with our kids.
Yep.
I'll have to show them. You're going to show them. They're going to forget 30 minutes later. Is that, it'll change their life for this long. Maybe they'll go into a career like that, but maybe they're not called to do that. Like, I truly, like, feed the need. We're all going to go to North Central and feed the need, and then we're going to go back to our safe place and change our lives for an hour and a half. What do I do with that?
Okay, so what did we just say? What is vulnerability? A practice that we continually do it in our embodied with it, right? So we have to practice it, which means we actually continually have to be there over and over again, remembering that we're there for connection over any kind of service. And we flip those, right? We flip those around. There's lots of ways, Heather, and it's one of the reasons we do projects, and yet I'm frustrated even with just the projects we can do. Believe me, God is giving you lots of opportunities, but it's something, like I can't say, whatever, what Cindy does to be vulnerable with people who are not like her is going to be different than what I do because God will bring into our lives different peoples and different opportunities and different, we live a life, you're right, that we are always in our safe place. We don't venture out. But there are ways that actually God just tries to keep bringing in, and we still close ourselves off with that. I'm hoping that as we go through this, we're going to begin to see ways that we can actually develop habits that actually make us vulnerable to people that are not like us. And it's going to start small, and it's going to take a long time. And it's not about us changing or them changing. It's about are we connecting or not? Because it's when you connect, right? It's when you actually know a refugee that the refugee story becomes your story. And see, I even just saying that, I mean, to me, it's just, it's my story. Because I know refugees. And they're no different than us. In fact, I could say they're better than us in many ways. Certainly better than I am. But I wouldn't have thought that if it was just information. I had to connect. I actually had to know refugee people to know that these people are valuable.
Mm-hmm. Your baby lived with them.
Lissa lived with refugee people. We had refugees here. And even that, see, I begin to think, see, I even call them something different, but I wouldn't call Mama Rita a refugee. I'd call her Mama Rita, mm-hmm. because this is somebody I know well, and she's an Iraqi, mm-hmm. who was a refugee in Syria. I mean, talk about, and her stories are, you know, amazing of what they had to go through. But see, I wouldn't feel that way had I not had connection with them.
Right.
And I didn't pursue that connection. My children have actually brought those connections to me. Mm-hmm. So these little openings, you know, we could have just let them go to Syria and not been involved. Mm-hmm. But God brings these little connections, and it's like God's opened the door. He says, you want to go in or not? And you go into those places. I always get sidetracked by that. So a practice of vulnerability, but also, and here this is a big one, a practice of paying attention to our own shame stories, to our own emotions and senses. It says, if you lack, which you might find, if you read James, and I bet in the Greek you might understand, but if you read James, you might understand under there, James has a little bit of sarcasm in several places, and this is one of them. If you lack. And I looked it up, I thought, well, maybe if is a third class condition, if and it's true. No, it's actually a conditional, if you lack. But I think this is a piece where James is going,
you all lack it.
But you need to come to understand that. I'm not going to tell you that. This is a way of saying you need to pay attention. You need to answer that question for yourself. So he's not going to say to you, you lack. I mean, he's not Paul. Paul's going to say, you lack. James is going to go, so if you lack, I think he's actually using a very Jewish way of talking.
If you need oxygen.
Yeah, right, exactly. So if you need oxygen, you know, pay attention. Make a practice of paying attention to what's going on inside of you. If we're going to let joy govern our lives, and even in the midst of trial, and we're not going to let the trial take our attention away from the joy of connection, if we're going to do that, I have got to stop and assess what story I'm inhabiting. I have to do that. And I have to understand what I'm feeling, because what I'm feeling is actually going to give us clues to our shame stories, to the stories we're inhabiting and the worldview we have, even though we would say, if someone asks us, what worldview do you have? Oh, I have a Christian worldview. I believe what God says. And then I will say, and what are you doing about the refugees? And you would say, well, they shouldn't come into the country. And then I say, well, what story are you inhabiting? Mm-hmm. Not God's story. But this is going to be, I'm going to guess, this is going to be really difficult for us. And one of the reasons is because the Enlightenment has told us that emotions don't matter. Mm-hmm. In fact, we should kind of discount emotions as far as what they do with our lives. Which is an interesting thing, and Christians have bought that, right? We say that we're not supposed to be emotional. But interesting, where did we get emotions from? Did we make them up? God gave them to us, right? He made us emotional creatures, and for a reason. So for us to discount emotion is to say, well, part of stuff that God's made in us is not important. It doesn't affect our life. And yet it does. All that to say, it might be hard for us to actually pay attention to our emotions. And when I first say these things to you, you're going to think I'm nuts. I need to understand, what am I feeling? I'm in a trial, what am I feeling? Am I feeling fear? Am I feeling accused? Am I feeling like I'm not enough? Am I feeling stupid? Am I feeling bad, like a bad person? Am I feeling wrong? Am I feeling failure? Am I feeling foolish or a loser? It's so interesting to listen to people's conversations and the language they use. And they, all of these things come out of shame. Every one of them come out of shame. Do I feel like I want to hide? Do I feel like I want to judge? Do I feel like I want to criticize? And I love it because when we get to those points, we always say, now, I don't want to judge, but I really do want to judge. So I need to know what fuel is propelling me. Remember, emotion for the mind is actually what keeps the mind going. So I need to know what fuel I'm using. Because I could be using the joy, which is what I'm supposed to use, which in its motion, it actually integrates the mind. But if I'm using another emotion, we'll see something different. So we need to know, what's our mind using? Is our mind using a fuel, something like coal, which actually gets us to be able to move where we want to move? It actually gets us to be able to get my life where I want it to be, a contextual language accomplished. But in the big picture, coal is not good for the whole rest of everybody else, right? It's very polluted, and it's actually harmful to others. Now remember, this is a metaphor, so I know you can go and tell me coal can be clean and all of that. It's a metaphor, guys. Or is the fuel you're using for your mind a perichoretic fuel? In other words, is it like the sun? When I use the sun, I can actually, like Pat, produce more fuel for other people. So Pat's house, solar, she brings in the sun and uses it. And guess what? She actually sells back electricity to the city. That's the kind of thing for us is, what emotion am I using to fuel my life? Am I using the joy that comes out of attachment, a secure attachment? Or am I using some other emotion in the wrong way? So what we need to do is befriend our emotional enemies. Now that sounds really weird. How do we befriend the enemies of anger and lust and critical? We befriend them by listening to what they're saying. So when I'm feeling angry, when I'm feeling lust, when I'm feeling critical, what is it saying? It's saying, I have an unmet need. And I really want to know who loves me. Does anyone love me? That's where anger comes from. That's where lust comes from. That's where criticism comes from. It all comes from shame. This is why we need to understand this. And it's asking a question. So the purpose of those emotions is to get us to stop and assess, look, I have a need that's unmet, and I'm not feeling love. They're clues to recognizing that we're feeling shame, that there's the pain of possible abandonment, when what we really need is connection. So instead of pushing our lust or our anger away, we can recognize, this is from Henry Nouwen, we can recognize that our anxious, driven hearts need some healing. Our restlessness can be converted into a deeper way of loving. There's a lot of unruly energy in lust and anger. When that energy can be directed toward loving well, we can transform not only ourselves, but those who might otherwise become the victims of our anger and lust. That was one of the devotions this week from Henry Nouwen. I just thought, wow, same language. In other words, we can act out the story of God and practice acting it out by moving toward connection, because it will lead us to joy. So in befriending those emotions, once we befriend them, once we say, okay, wait a second, I don't need to push those out, I need to befriend them. Wait, they're there for something good. So when I'm feeling angry, our Christian response is usually, I'm not supposed to feel angry, so I need to not feel angry, right? Mm-hmm. And we try, what happens when you do that? I'm not supposed to feel angry, so it comes out somewhere else, right? God says, no, wait a second, I gave you the emotion for a purpose. Mm-hmm. befriend it, realize it has some good for you, and then name and tend it. Now that sounds really, what? You're going to name and tend anger? Yeah. Because anger is valuable, because it's a warning to pay attention to connection and not to another way of defining life. Mm-hmm. That's why anger comes up. That's why lust comes up. That's why all of those come up. Not for you to ignore them and push them aside, because if you push them aside, they're still there. Mm-hmm. But to acknowledge them and say, wait, you're valuable. You're a warning for me. You're a warning system to say, I'm in the middle of being ready to use a contextual language and define life in a different way. That's what that is there. That's why making a habit of paying attention to what you're feeling is so important. How many of you, when something comes up, a situation comes up, and you feel something, you stop and you go, oh, now, wait a second, what am I feeling? How many of you do that?
I have done it.
Okay, you've done it, yeah. What James is telling us is we need to pay attention to that. We need to make a practice of paying attention to that. And not just when trials come, right? But we need to make a practice of it every day, paying attention to what I'm feeling. And is this a warning? Or is this, let's go forward in that? It's a warning like the crossing gates or the red light at a train, right? There's a purpose for it. I don't like a crossing gate. I don't like the red lights. But if I ignore them and say, oh, just go away. I still remember once in my life, little kids, and in fact, it's the railroad crossing that I have to cross every day to go to school. I remember going around the gates. Mm-hmm. And to this day, I just feel, oh my goodness, what danger did I put all of us in? Mm-hmm. That's the thing about ignoring anger, pushing it aside, ignoring lust, pushing it aside, and pretending it's not there. It's like pretending that those gates aren't there. I just keep going forward into where I'm going. You see, anger, lust, all of those what we call bad emotions are there as warnings to say, you're going in the wrong direction. You're about to define life as not relationship. Stop.
So, for example, if I was President Trump, and all these people coming against me, I should be possibly taking some time out to say, well, what are you trying to say to me in all this?
Yes.
Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Because, like,
yes.
I can remember I had a boss that was really harsh with me, and she wasn't a Christian, and I was accused of trying to proselytize this gal who was definitely a Satan worshiper, and it was a mess. But I had come to the point where my connection with my boss was more important than trying to be right in that situation.
Yes. Yeah.
Even.
And that's really important for
and
us.
And that,
to
yeah. And that was hard for me because I was really
right.
angry.
Right. And that's a point where you had to submit, why am I angry here?
Mm-hmm.
Because the anger is going toward, I need to be right, right?
Right.
I need
right.
to go toward that place.
Right.
If we're going to tend the feelings, it means let them do what they're supposed to be doing for you. Why am I given anger? As a warning. So when I tend them, it's to say, let anger be the warning. So heed them. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
if I don't heed them, I push them to the side and they bubble up in a different place. I need to allow them to work the way they're supposed to work. Let them tell you, I'm warning you, you're going down the wrong way. Heed them. Stop, turn around, go the other way. That's why scripture says, be angry, but do not sin. We struggle with that all the time, right? How can we do both? That's how we do both. That's the beautiful side of shame. That's why shame is neutral to the mind, because shame is a warning. It's not the truth. It's a warning that you're going to use that as a way to go away from life. It gives you the space and the opportunity to practice integration, bring yourself to wholeness, allowing the warning to redirect you toward connection, attention back to life, rather than going down the path of some kind of contextual language. And the third practice we need to practice vulnerability. We need to practice paying attention to our emotions, to what's going on inside, and we need to practice seeking attachment. And so this is where he's going to go with 5 through 8. So all of that came out of two words, if you laugh. And so you know why we're not going to get through James. At the time of our shame, then, we have two doors in which we can go, move toward. If I'm feeling stupid, which is a shame response, if I'm feeling stupid, I can say to myself, I'm feeling stupid, so I will do something to mitigate that, right? Mm-hmm. And that's our most common response. I'm feeling stupid, so I'm going to do something to mitigate that feeling. Or the other door is, I'm feeling stupid. Karen, would you help me? You see the difference in that? What did that require?
Vulnerability.
Huge vulnerability, right? That is a way of practicing attachment. So the two, and it seems so simple. I'm feeling stupid. Well, I don't, and this is where it stops. I'm feeling stupid. I don't want to feel stupid. Why don't I want to feel stupid? Oh, because I don't want to feel shame. I don't want to feel disconnected. And when I say I feel stupid, so I'm going to show everybody how smart I am in some way or another, is moving outside of connection. But if I say I'm feeling stupid, oh, that's a warning that I'm moving away from connection. Mm-hmm. Oh, then my response needs to be connection. Karen, could you help me? Does that make sense?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Let me tell you, this is a huge, huge paradigm shift for you to actually practice. In your head, you're going, oh, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, that's good. Now, I can almost guarantee, and I'll just pray for it, that God is going to bring to you, when you leave this house, an instant where you're going to say, I'm feeling stupid. I'm feeling, you won't even say it because we're so unaware. But you'll feel stupid, and you'll actually do something to mitigate that feeling, mm-hmm. rather than moving toward connection. If you're trying to mitigate those feelings, you're moving toward disconnection, right? But if the only way to really mitigate that feeling of disconnection is to connect, ask for help. This is how I'm feeling. Ask for help.
I think women will stop and ask directions.
Women will ask directions, but we're not very good in any other area. Yeah. It is.
Because I'm surrounded by super smart people.
Okay, and what did she just tell us? Her story is that everybody else is smart. And the funny thing is, if you know Karen, she's really smart.
She is very smart.
Yeah, I grew up with a near genius sister and blah, blah,
blah. Did you just hear that?
Yeah.
Yep. And that's, guys, that vulnerability that Karen just said, you all have those stories. I'd like to hear those stories. We'd all like to hear those stories because what Karen just did helped us, right? Mm-hmm. That helps us to hear the voices of this is how it looks in my life, because mm-hmm. it looks like that in your life too.
Crying out. Mm-hmm.
Crying out for help. This is so helpful. Last week after class, like I was like kind of shattered. Like, well, that was a horrible class. Nobody understood what was going on. And three women stood around me and said, are you kidding? And they gave me a different story. Had that not happened, I would have walked away with, here's the story about what happened. And I had already, literally, I'm sitting here, people aren't getting it, and I'm going, okay, so how am I going to describe this failure to Ben, who always asks about?
Oh my gosh.
Literally.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But see, this is the things we do mm-hmm. that we just do them naturally, and we forget that that's actually what's going on. I would have continued with that story, except for the intervention of other people, right? Because I don't have everything. I don't see everything. And the funny thing is, I think I see a lot. Like, I know a lot of your body movements. I know your facial expressions. I know what's going on there.
Oh, dear.
What? But I don't know everything, right?
And oh, and sometimes when you see discomfort, you are assuming what it's mean, but God's
so it goes to my story, right?
Yeah.
So when I see somebody doesn't get it, what's my story?
You're a failing.
Exactly. So you see how it just shapes everything and how we go. And unless we get connection, those stories don't change. And it has to be habitual connection. So every week afterwards, somebody has to say, this is how the truth truly went. Because maybe some days that I walk out and I go, wow, that was a great class.
And you want us to be like, yeah.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I need a book, right? So this practice of seeking content, attachment, that's the path toward integration, right? That's where we're going to get joy, is out of that connection with one another. So it's an intentional choice for connection with God first and with others as well, so that my attention is turned toward connection rather than the trial, so that Karen's attention is turned toward connection rather than her inabilities, right, which is her trial. So how do we practice seeking attachment? First and foremost, by asking. This is what James says, right? If you lack, ask. That asking, first of all, is an acknowledgement of your need of another, as well as an openness to being known. If I ask, it means I can't do something. I'm showing you I can't do something, but I also am saying I need you. That's vulnerability. That's that nakedness. But when are we asked? What is said here in the Greek that we can't see in English is, it's not when you're in trial, ask. It's always ask. Mm-hmm. This is a practice. This is a habitual embodiment of asking. We are not good asking people. We are horrible at that. We don't like to ask. We like to do things on our own.
But we don't want to impose either.
We don't want what?
Impose on someone. Mm-hmm.
And
that's a contextual language.
That's a contextual language. That is a story we've told ourselves, that imposing is bad.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Here's the thing that the poor have to tell us. They wouldn't say that. Mm-hmm. They would never look at asking as an imposition. And they wouldn't say that because they've lived in a place where life, you have to ask.
Yeah, right.
You can't do life on your own. And this is this is where James wants to get to. Those of us who are rich, every one of us here, we have lived life so independently that we begin to think that asking is imposition. Now, does that mean that asking the person you are asking won't see it as imposition? No, but that's not your responsibility. Your responsibility is to be the priest who does the connection first.
You know, I've had someone say to me a few years ago, when my husband's dad died, his brother died, and his dad died, and we were in charge of doing everything. And she asked me what I needed, and I said nothing. And she said, please don't rob me the chance of helping you because you don't want to ask. And, I mean, it was so convicting to me that I was like, oh. Because I said the same thing to someone yesterday who didn't want to ask me for something, and I said, rob me the joy of being able to do it for you by not asking. She's like, oh, okay. We think it's an imposition, but the worst that they can say is, I can't.
Right, exactly, exactly. So asking is a really important practice. So in other words, it's not to where you get to the very last point of, oh, now I can't do anything. Now I'll ask. It actually should be how our life works all the time. It should be so natural to us. And this is this reforming of being able to ask. And so he says, ask. That should be a liturgy in your life, asking, practicing asking. So just for a suggestion, go home today and every opportunity, ask somebody for something. Ask somebody to help. Every opportunity.
Yesterday, I just emailed my teacher 20 questions over chapter 1 and lesson 1 and 2 of how to use Lightroom, which is a new computer program for dealing with pictures and stuff. 20 questions in two chapters.
Yeah. Somebody else got a question?
I have a question.
Karen.
It says, if any of you lacks wisdom, like, are we leaving that out, or are we just assuming it's encompassing?
Do you see the next point?
Next point, too.
Let's ask God.
On your outline.
In the outline? For wisdom.
I'm just reading the Bible.
Yeah. Unfortunately, you know, James 1 is actually the nugget of what he'll expand on throughout. This is why we're going through it so slowly. So, yes, I'm going through word by word. Okay, so ask for wisdom. Now, we got to really parse that out because we think we know what it means. What is it that we lack?
Connection.
So that when I ask for wisdom, I'm actually asking for connection. Wisdom is the realm of the Holy Spirit. So you'll go through all scripture and you'll see wisdom, Sophia, is always connected with the Holy Spirit. So the request is a request for connection with the Spirit, a connection within the perichoretic circle. So you'll notice James later in 3, he says that wisdom is, so wisdom from above is pure, peaceable, and he goes through 7 different things, or 9 different things, I can't remember. It looks a lot like, where the gifts of the Holy, the fruit of the Holy Spirit are, love, joy, peace. Looks a lot like it. It's actually an echo of that. And since that's found in Galatians, and this is in James, they're written at the same time. They're the exact same thing. When you ask for wisdom, you're asking for the Holy Spirit's presence, that you can join in that perichoretic circle. That's what you're asking for. John talks about that the Holy Spirit will be sent in Jesus' name to you to teach you all things and remind you of everything I've said to you. So that when you're asking for wisdom, you're not asking for information, which is what we want, right? We want information. And why do we want information? To know what to do,
but we can be independent.
So we can be independent. And that's exactly right. We want information so we can get our contextual languages accomplished, so we can get and do what we want need to do. And yet, what is it that is life? Is it information? Is it knowing?
Connection.
It's connection. So don't let anyone tell you that we are to ask for knowledge. We are to ask for information. We are to ask for wisdom. We are to ask for Holy Spirit presence that we might discern how to connect in this situation.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say discernment.
Yeah.
I ask for that a lot.
But it's discernment not to know what to do, what is right, mm-hmm. but to know how to connect in this situation.
Well,
yeah.
Yep. He was, it was not just connecting his kingdom, but it was like how to answer a situation when they brought in 2 mothers bring a child.
Yep, good. Brought it up. Great. But it's completely connecting. It's what he got was a way to discern how to connect with relationships. So what does he do when the 2 prostitutes bring this baby that one says is theirs and the other says it's hers? What does he do?
He says he's going to cut it in half.
He says he's going to cut it in half. Right. Okay. What does that do?
Makes them work it out.
It makes them work it out and say, wait, connection is more important. Mm-hmm. That mom, the real mom, said to the fake mom, you can have the baby. Mm-hmm. That's discernment. How do I bring connection here out of this situation?
But the wisdom for him was, which you're calling discernment, is what to do in that situation.
No, God didn't say, Solomon, go get a sword and say you're going to cut the babies in half. That's not what God gave him. God said, make sure that these women come out of this with connection being the most important thing. Does that make sense to you?
No.
Yeah. No.
I had a really interesting experience last night. A high school girl called who was really upset, and I said, come over and... She's telling me, you know, these people don't like me. These people are talking about me and this and this and this and this. And I felt the Holy Spirit say, ask her what's going on in her life. You know, and I said, what's going on in your life? And she said, my dad just
moved and he didn't say goodbye and he put all my stuff on the porch, you know, and I'm like, oh gosh, you know, and that's supposed to be her first connection. And so of course she feels like every, so I don't know exactly, you know, where that's gonna go, but I felt like God had me ask her, like, okay, I don't think it's about other teenagers, you know, and so I don't know. That's just a little
so what Karen, what happens is God gives you, when you're asking for wisdom and his presence there, what he's going to give you is what is going to move toward connection, allowing you in your way, because you may move connection toward connection a different way than Kim would. But what he gives you as wisdom is his presence to say, remember, it's about connection. What's going to move you toward connection? When we want wisdom as information, we want to know, just tell me the right answer so I can get on with life. That there's a little bit of difference there. You will come up with something to do. But what he's giving you is, here's my presence, remember, connect. Which, what is going to move toward connection rather than what's going to move towards solving the problem? Okay? I know this is not actually how we want to do life. We want to do life, right? How many times have I heard any of us say, if God would just write down exactly what I'm supposed to do, I'd do it every day. The problem is, God doesn't want you to know what to do. He wants you to come to him and have connection.
But he wants the connection. You know, I've been praying for wisdom for my son, who is nonverbal and has been going through a really, you know, stressful time with his autism. And he's anxious and he's banging his head on the floor. So I'm really looking for some real wisdom to help him.
Yep.
You know what I mean? So that's where I get a little, like, because I've been praying for real wisdom to have answers to how to help him. But I feel like I am connecting to God by even coming, you know, to him.
But
to connect Preston to him to, like, you know what I mean? I guess I'm
so, Jen, and obviously I can't answer that for you, right? I can't tell you what to do. But God wants, more importantly, I want you to ask, how can I connect with Preston? How can I actually connect other people with Preston? Which is probably something that's a little bit like, I don't want to really do that, right? Yeah. That's harder, right? But it's about, in other words, it's not about getting, okay, this is going to sound weird. It's not about getting Preston to stop banging his head on the floor so much as it is connecting with Preston, which will result in some good for Preston. We're very focused on the material. I don't like this behavior. I don't like what's happening to me. I want to get rid of the trial. And this is actually where James goes. You so much want to get rid of the trial, you don't want to get the good out of the trial. You don't want to sit in the trial and allow the connections that happen, right? Because you just want it to be done. And Jen, in your case, I mean, you've dealt with this for a long time. So yes, we want to get out of that, right? And we want the best for Preston. But the best for Preston is connection on the level he can get, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. Is it sort of like the thing that you read just at the beginning?
Yes. Yeah.
Sometimes I pray for people to come, like, God, send me somebody that will, that's what I like, pray for people to come to me.
Yeah.
Or send people to somebody who needs help, like, send people to you. Or
right.
Or whatever.
Right.
Like,
right. And in that.
Out there, I just don't know who it is.
Would you, and this is the part of asking for wisdom, make me open to whomever you send to me as somebody who has something to give me that I don't have, and that I might accept that other as actually somebody valuable.
It's funny because kids won't even ask questions for help.
Not here.
Like my kids, I'm like, there's no stupid questions.
Yeah.
You probably have the same question somebody else has. Like, we have to teach our kids to ask for help.
And why do we need to do that?
We don't model it.
Because we don't, first of all, we don't model it. It's not the story we've been telling them. It's not the story we tell here in this culture. Now, you go to other cultures and you'll have a different story on that.
Well, that's why that whole, you can be anything you want to be, just drives
me crazy.
Oh, my God.
I hate that.
But to me, it's like, what? Because that, to me, that just says you're completely independent. You can do it. You can do it on
yes,
your own.
Yes, exactly.
You can do it on
that's
your
so
own.
True.
You don't need anybody
that's so
else.
True. On top of it, it's not even true. Well, you can't.
Right.
You can't be whoever you want to be. Right. Because you are so intricately connected with all of the other that there are oh, America hates this, right? There are places you can't go and places you can't.
There are limitations.
There are limitations, yes.
You know what I was kind of, I've been thinking about too, in a church body for it to function in a healthy way then, there needs to be that transparency in a place where people can ask questions.
Yes.
And
yes.
not right. feel, you Judged. Know. Right?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep.
In a healthy way.
Exactly. Which is why it always starts with the practice of vulnerability.
Yeah.
We're still on page one.
Maybe we'll finish the chapter one at the end of the semester. Is this helpful to you?
Yes.
You know, there's a piece of me that's panicking.
No.
And then
you're exposing us to something that is
you're
so beautiful.
So what's that story that's making you panic?
Oh, you've heard it. Like I'm efficient, I'm smart, I can do this, I can get this all in. And Karen's word keep coming back to me over and over again. So what would it matter if we continued James in the next semester?
Right. Yeah.
And like I'm like going, well, we can't do that. We can't do that.
Why
she
not?
Said,
we're not in a college class. You're not the teacher that has to get us free to get to the test.
Which I think is why God is no make sure that that's not where I'm going toward. Although I still would like to give a test.
In my Sunday school class at church, we study a book of the Bible word by word, and everybody asks questions, and we go off on rabbit trails. Mm-hmm. And so to do a book, it would take us like 2 years.
I know.
Or 3 years. I mean, who cares?
And there are some practical reasons I care. And one of them is because it's really hard to bring new people in.
Right.
If I'm doing that.
That's true. That is true.
Well, so they only get through one chapter, then they can just read that chapter.
That's true.
They're just far behind.
That's true.
Let me just say that I'm so, I'm just like,
to
let you know, I so appreciate what we've been talking about in this last weekend. Yeah. I was in a very uncomfortable situation where I knew I was not wanted there. And I had the choice before that I could have chosen not to connect. But I went in, and the whole time I kept reminding myself of the joy of my connection with God. Thank you. And then I kept praying for wisdom. God, how do I connect in this situation where I know that I'm not wanted? And, you know, I got through it. That was amazing. You know, I mean, I was so in touch. Like you said, as you were talking, I was thinking, I was so in touch with my feelings. I knew exactly why I was feeling certain ways. And instead of, like, trying to defend, trying to, you know, I was just, how do I connect?
Yes.
And what do they have to offer me?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm so grateful that we
talked about this. Yeah, I think it is why I'm very much like we need to get this and we need to dig deeper with this. And I keep going back to, I don't remember even what book we were studying when we had, remember I had you practice conversations?
The
Socratic method.
Esther.
It was Esther. Okay.
Yeah.
So we actually practiced conversing with one another. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember the name of that style. It was called.
It was
something about saying, I know you have something to offer me in this conversation.
Appreciative
inquiry.
Very
good. I kept coming back to that is we need to be in that place of appreciative inquiry, and which is why I appreciate when you guys chime in, because it helps. It helps all of us to be able to understand that. Of course, and then it gets into my shame response, and I go, oh my gosh, we got to go. Come on, look at all these things. Anyway, asking for wisdom is a discernment for how to choose connection with God and others at the same time in this situation. And here's the thing, this goes right to Karen's question. When I am discerning of how to connect with God and others, when I actually do the connection within that trial, what comes out of connection? Joy, right? And do you remember what comes out of joy?
Love.
The freedom to be able to be creative. Mm-hmm. That's then where your answer comes. Mm-hmm. You see that? So I'm able to creative. This is what happened with Robin. When this little girl is asking, she's asking for wisdom. The Holy Spirit says, connect. How about connections? What's going on with her connection? She asks that. That connection actually brings out the joy of her freedom. Robin is pulling on the connection she has with the Holy Spirit, and she has the freedom to be creative about that. Mm-hmm. Now, did she go through all those, like, in her mind? No, it just came, right? But it became, and this is why practice of asking for wisdom, not being a practice for asking for information, it then becomes part of you. And so for Robin, I think it has become quite a bit a part of her. Mm-hmm. And she has the freedom to be creative.
We have to listen also.
Well, that's coming in, James. We're not there yet. Verse 19. Yep. So, when I ask for wisdom, according to James, when I'm asking for the Holy Spirit's connection to have discernment of how to connect in this situation, I give God an opening. I make myself vulnerable to say, I need connection here, not an answer. When I say I need an answer, I've actually closed myself off from opening to God, right? Mm-hmm. If all I want is, I mean, it's like saying, All I want, Michelle, from you is, if you were just going to my papers and, you know, be done, that's all I want.
Transaction, like you
said. A transaction, right? Exactly, yeah. A transaction. And what I would get from that is I would get my papers done, but I would have no joy out of it. But instead what's happened is I've had more connection with Michelle because of her editing my papers than, like, here's the funny thing. It's come from the first paper she ever edited. I thought, wow, she's a great editor. This is going to be great for me. I would always go, literally, I'm thinking this is going to be great. And I couldn't wait. So the next paper was like, I can't wait to see what she says and how I need to change. Well, it goes on, and by this time, so she just edited a paper for me. I didn't even look at the paper. No. I'm looking at our conversation, like, and texting her back the conversation, and we have this conversation going. And then I thought, oh, I forgot to look at the paper. The joy that came out of the connection. But if I would just said, all you're there for me for is being an editor. Do you see the difference there?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's so much life in the connection, mm-hmm. not very much life in the I'll connect for you for you to be able to mm-hmm. me accomplish yeah. my yeah. contextual language. So,
Jill,
yeah.
You said something. Texting back and forth.
Yep.
Why didn't you make a phone call? It would have been so much quicker. This is my feeling going on.
No. I love to text. I don't
talk about it. It's like old-fashioned letter writing.
It was actually email. So it was like long. Yeah, yeah, it was email.
It was long.
Yeah, it was long.
Yeah, part of that, so part of me not talking on the phone is part of my baggage that I go, mm-hmm. Was it late?
Yeah, I wrote you in the night. So,
oh, yeah. So, I don't know.
Yeah.
Anyway, us asking opens up a place for us to receive what God has to give, and now God can give himself fully, right? So what he gives himself when we ask for wisdom and not information, so you might use the word wisdom, but if you're asking for information, you might not get it. But when I open for him, he gives himself. And that's the most important thing, that he gives himself. James bases his confidence that God will respond in here, how he talks about that God will respond, on God's character. Remember that in the beginning, Genesis 1, we see that God is the one who's vulnerable, right? He's the one who opens himself up. Remember what the word vulnerable means, vulnerable? To be open to wounding, to be open to rejection. God puts himself in harm's way simply by making us. His openness, though, God's openness and his vulnerability was secured by his relational connection within the Trinity. So that prevented fear and shame from actually ruling his anticipated future.
I have no idea what you just said. Okay. Does anybody else?
No. Yeah.
God could be vulnerable in making us. Right? He knows when he makes us that he's opening himself up to possible pain. Mm-hmm. Right? He knows that. Mm-hmm. But he's able to do that because he's secure in his attachment within himself.
Okay.
All right? And then that, because he knows that no matter what happens with humanity that he makes, the way he opens himself up to humanity, he knows that his relationship within the perichoretic circle is actually strong enough to hold him there and keep him connected. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Isn't that the same strength that Jesus had then?
That's exactly why Jesus says in John over and over again, I am in the Father in me, and so I can be open to you.
Well, and I think that's when we have our true identity and who God says we are, then we can risk being vulnerable and rejected and disconnected from people.
Yep, right. Which is exactly what James is trying to get here with this first chapter. Because he's going to want us to be vulnerable to all sorts of people and in all sorts of ways and actually get rid of that old story that we've been carrying around. But we have to know that we are secure in our relationship with the Trinity because that's what will sustain us through the trials. It's also what will grow in the trials. So what we know from that, God giving him himself vulnerably, we know that that's actually the norm. Deep relationship is the norm. And then James says that he will give, and he will give himself generously. That word actually, the word haplos, actually means singleness of heart or single-minded, undividedly, unwavering intent. Like, he's not going, well, you know, I'm gonna give to them, but man, you know, I'm gonna keep a little bit of myself away because they are gonna hurt me. He just gives completely openly, and the word with reproach, I think, is actually, is that what it says here? Without reproach?
Yeah.
Means without shame alarms needing to go off. It is unreserved, without reprimand for past failures or reminding us endlessly of the value of his gift. Think about that. God gives without reproach. He gives not saying, by the way, you are going to appreciate this gift, right? You're going to appreciate me, right? Because if you're not going to appreciate me, you know, I'm going to be disappointed. He doesn't give saying, you know, you haven't wanted to connect with me before, but I'll, you know, just this once more. That's not how God gives. He just gives. He's unconditional. It's just like, there it is. And there are no strings attached to it. There are no, I'm going to give you, but if you don't appreciate me, I'm going to pull back. See, he doesn't say that. He actually, that's what that word actually means, without reproach. He has no strings to giving himself fully. That's how we're supposed to reflect, right? To give ourselves fully, vulnerably. His integrity in giving himself, it doesn't call into question attachment. But when we give ourselves, we almost always have some question of attachment there, right? Like, I'm going to give to you. And we don't say it, right? We embody it. Like, we're very reticent. Well, I'm going to share this much of myself, but not so much, right? Because, and as soon as we do that, the other person knows you're not willing to share your whole self. And that there is now this, well, she's not willing to share her whole self. Should I be willing to share my whole self? So it becomes this cycle. He gives himself fully and unashamedly. He's unashamed to give himself fully to people who are constantly wanting to disconnect from him. Right? He already knows this. These are people who will disconnect from him over and over. But he's unashamed to give himself fully to the other. We say, we always counsel people, oh, if they're going to hurt you all the time, then back off, right? Put a wall. Now, I mean, there are some interesting dynamics in there, but God doesn't do that. So God gives himself in such a way that we feel his joy in giving to us. 2 weeks ago, I went out with someone who gave me a gift, and I just loved the gift. It was really great, and she said, "I just delight in delighting you." Wasn't that cool?
Yeah.
And you just think, yeah, that's God. That's what God is. I just delight in giving myself to you. It's just so fun. We have a strange idea of God in his holiness about him being stoic. Mm-hmm. But he's not. He's fully giving. And when we allow that, when we receive that, we realize he's getting joy out of giving to me. Which I think that's what we need to understand when we're asking for wisdom. He gives completely and fully, and he's giving him himself so that we feel the joy in his giving. It's that echo of, I'm so glad to be with you. And I'm glad that you and I get to create together. So that we practice asking for wisdom, his presence, his teaching me how to connect, in a very embodied way. In other words, and here's the deal. I'm still working on, like, how do I do this? Because it needs to be embodied. Embodied isn't thinking. So thinking isn't particularly embodied so much. We need to actually have our physical body do something with that. So that perhaps it needs to be spoken, that our physical body would actually do that. So that it, we live, how many of you live in your head? Right? We do that. The problem is we're not embodying that. We're not getting our body involved in that. And so to practice asking, my guess is that practice asking is probably going to require us to actually say it out loud, which is why we end our, one of the reasons we end our time with confessing with one another. We actually say with our bodies a request, right? Which I think is probably where we're at, right?
Oh.
Wow, sorry. With that, let us go to our confession.
Time flies when you're having fun.
I had so many other things to share and good stories.
Next week.
So let us go before the Father and ask with our mouths, and perhaps make it a practice. James will end in 5 by saying we are to confess to one another. An embodied practice. Let us embody the practice of asking God. I forget how it starts this morning. Most merciful God,
we confess that we have sinned against you in thought, word, and deed, by what we have done and by what we have left undone. We have not loved you with our whole heart. We have not loved our neighbors as ourselves. We are truly sorry, and we humbly repent. For the sake of your Son, Jesus Christ, have mercy on us and forgive us, that we may delight in your will and walk in your ways to the glory of your name.